Reactions to Patel's announcement were predictably polarized. A Hamas official said that it showed absolute bias towards the Israeli regime occupation and is a submission to Israeli regime blackmail and dictations. He accused the UK of supporting the aggressors at the expense of the victims. The Board of Deputies of British Jews warmly welcomed the move. In the Israeli regime media, the British decision was hailed as a triumph for the Zionist regime's diplomacy. At a deeper level, the shift in British policy was a product of the close ties between the fake regime of Israel and the Conservative Party. The fake regime of Israel and its powerful lobby had been pressing the British government on this issue for some time. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett urged Boris Johnson to outlaw the whole of Hamas when he met with him last month at the UN climate conference in Glasgow. Patel needed no prompting to do the Zionist regime's bidding. In 2017, as Secretary of State for International Development, Patel went on a freelance trip to the occupied territories without informing then Prime Minister Theresa May or Boris Johnson, then Foreign Secretary. While pretending to be on a private holiday, Patel held a series of secret meetings with high-ranking Zionist regime officials, including the then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Lord Polak, president of the Conservative Friends of Israel, personally arranged 12 of these meetings. Upon her return, Patel asked her officials to explore the possibility of diverting some of the foreign aid budget to enable the Zionist regime army to carry out humanitarian work in the occupied Golan Heights. She was forced to resign and she accepted her actions fell below the high standards that are expected of a Secretary of State. Close contact with Zionist regime officials and lobbyists for Israel in the UK, as well as her own right-wing worldview, left Patel eager to swallow Zionist regime's narrative about Hamas. This narrative is utterly distorted and blatantly self-serving. Here, however, are some of the relevant facts. True friends do not indulge their friends' addiction, but try to win them from it. Boris Johnson could hardly be more indulgent. His partisanship extends to resisting all international attempts to call the Israeli regime to account for its acts of aggression and unlawful behavior. He is opposed, for example, to the International Criminal Court investigation into war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories committed by the fake regime of Israel. In a letter to the Conservative Friends of Israel, he said that while his government had respect for the independence of the court, it opposed this particular inquiry. This investigation gives the impression of being a partial and prejudicial attack on a friend and ally of the UK's, he wrote. The perverse logic of the statement is that being a friend and ally of the UK places the Israeli regime above international law. One final question. Why was the latest anti-Palestinian policy shift announced by the Home Secretary rather than the Foreign Secretary? Patel claims that designating the whole of Hamas as a terrorist organization should be seen through a domestic prism. It will help to protect Jews in this country. This is preposterous. Hamas exercises its right under international law to resist the Israeli regime occupation, the most prolonged and brutal military occupation of modern times. Fear-mongering and criminalizing the political wing of Hamas will not make British Jews any safer. In May, in a massively disproportionate use of force, the fake regime of Israel carried out an aerial bombardment of Gaza that resulted in the death of 256 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Community Security Trust, a charity concerned with the safety and security of Jews in the UK, recorded a horrific surge in racist attacks during that month, which surpassed anything we have seen before. If the British government genuinely wanted to make Jews in this country feel safer, it should stop blaming the Palestinian victims for their own misfortune. It should urge its Israeli ally to respect international humanitarian law, to observe ceasefire agreements, to exercise restraint in the use of military force, and to talk to the political leadership of Hamas. Peitel's latest move only serves to expose the utter bankruptcy of the conservative government's policy toward Israel-Palestine. The government claims to support a two-state solution to the conflict, yet, despite the repeated parliamentary votes in favor of recognizing Palestine, the government refuses to budge. When he was Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson told the House of Commons that the conservative government would recognize Palestine when the time was right. But the government he now heads, the time will never be right. Timing is just an excuse to procrastinate while continuing to appease the Zionist regime. To be sure, British recognition of Palestine would not redress the huge asymmetry of power between the two parties, but it would give the Palestinians parity of esteem. This is the least that Britain can do for the Palestinians today, given its long series of betrayals, stretching back to the Balfour Declaration over a century ago. In his 2014 book, The Churchill Factor, Johnson wrote that the Balfour Declaration was bizarre, a tragically incoherent document and an exquisite piece of F.O. Fujerma. Today, from his position of power, Johnson has a unique opportunity to rectify an egregious historical wrong. Criminalizing Hamas may please the Zionist regime and the right wing of his party, but it will only further blacken Britain's already dark record as the betrayer of the Palestinian people.
Part 1.
Playing golf is important for bankers. It's a good place to talk to clients because no one is going to listen to you on the golf course. The high net worth individuals, you would meet them in the office. I worked in 8 secrecy jurisdictions, Cayman Islands, BVI, Bermuda, Guernsey, Jersey, Isle of Man, Mauritius, all of them had golf courses. When I was in the Caymans, I had the option to play golf and to learn golf and to entertain clients, and that was great. I mean, but, you know, basically I do think it's a boring sport because you put the ball on the ground, hit it once and another movement, it's it's kind of boring. I rather prefer soccer where you've got more action, you've got the team play, you've got...
Rudolf Elmer worked for 15 years for Bank Julius Baer, one of Switzerland's largest private banks. He started out as basic auditor in Zurich and ended up deputy CEO of the bank's Cayman Islands branch. It was there, in the Caribbean, that his life changed dramatically at the start of the 2000s. A murky tale of unpaid medical expenses, an overly critical mind, all played out in an atmosphere of professional rivalry with his superior. In 2003, Bank Julius Baer fired Rudolf Elmer in circumstances that were, to say the least, troubling. Security breaches had been uncovered at the Grand Cayman branch, and six executives, including Elmer, were asked to undergo a rather unusual test. Since this clash, Rudolf Elmer's life has become a never-ending fight. First against Bank Julius Baer, but also against international tax evasion, and then against the judicial system of his home country, Switzerland. Rudolf Elmer carried on his fight in the shadows while continuing his career in the banking world. He worked in Mauritius for the offshore branch of Africa's largest bank.
I worked for Standard Bank as a head of fiduciary services, and my project was to outsource trusts and companies from Isle of Man to Mauritius, and I was on a 2 years contract. I was pretty successful because staff and even management nominated me to the superstar of Standard Bank. All right, I didn't make it, but I was nominated. So everything looked fine, and we were in discussion to go on with my contract. And then there was that day when I was asked by management to come down in the office, and then I was told I don't need to come to the office tomorrow. They have received some information, and they have to sort it out first, and I don't need to come to the office. And I didn't know what was going on, but... In the background, or the information I received, is information out of Julius Baer.
Elmer's a very conservative man. He comes from a very, very poor working class background, and he's made it into the heart of the Swiss establishment, into the financial sector. And he is, or was for years, extremely loyal to the financial sector, unusually loyal, because he has made it out of nowhere to be a somebody. And therefore, I think it was a real shock to him when the system started to let him down, when it behaved badly, and then when he complained about that bad behavior, when it ejected him. So I think he was completely unprepared to play this role of whistleblower, and it's taken him literally years to work out how to do it, and it's really only recently that he's understood how to do it by coming out publicly and trying to build alliances who can help him to get the truth out.
A few weeks before being fired from Standard Bank, Rudolf Elmer went through the looking glass, so to speak. After 5 years of ambivalence, he finally opted to openly become a whistleblower. He started by sending hundreds of confidential documents from Bank Julius Baer to a then virtually unknown website. Started on January the 9th, 2008, with over 200 pages of documents related to the former leader of Hong Kong, Tung Chi Hwa. I discovered the flagship product sold by the bank to its ultra-rich clients, Cayman Islands Trusts. A trust is a private contract in which the client hands over his or her fortune to a trustee in order to become non-taxable. But in most cases, clients continue to manage their assets covertly with the help of the bank. The trust is therefore a smokescreen to facilitate tax fraud. The Dragon Trust, created by Tung Chi Hwa, held nearly $20 million in accounts in Zurich, London, and Hong Kong. A few days later, WikiLeaks published the banking files of five other clients, including a Greek shipping magnate, Anna Kanalakis. Her trust owns a fleet of tankers and a bank account in Zurich worth $30 million. The bank was quick to react to these leaks, which were growing day by day.
Bank Julius Baer hired lawyers in LA. And the lawyers in LA represent the Hollywood stars. They're very, very aggressive at trying to basically use abusive process to shut down publications. Their tactic was to spray out subpoenas, spray out legal demands, and move extremely quickly. So they had a court case without even us turning up. And a temporary restraining order was issued, which knocked off the WikiLeaks domain name for about 10 days. Now, that was great for us. The New York Times read editorials on it. Our IP address was published around the world. We managed to build up a coalition of 22 different lawyers and came back in about 10 days' time with this very significant coalition. And there was extremely substantial media exposure. Each one of these lawyers or legal groups in the coalition, of course, put out press releases. We put out our own press release. And so we made Bank Julius Baer bleed, really bleed, from the negative publicity associated with that. And as a result, they had to cancel their US IPO, their initial public offering on the stock market, of the US registration of Bank Julius Baer, which cost them hundreds of millions. And so they pulled out of the case.
Galvanized by this victory, WikiLeaks resumed publication of the Julius Baer files. Some clearly stated that the bank accepts undeclared funds. Other documents raised more questions. Why did the daughter of British sculptor Henry Moore set up the Spencer Trust to transfer works of art from Liechtenstein and Panama to the British Virgin Islands and the Cayman Islands? Then there was the Moonstone Trust, set up for the wealthy German industrialist Robert Schuller. His home was searched on Christmas Eve 2009 as a consequence of the documents leaked by Rudolf Elner to WikiLeaks. To protect his anonymity, the businessman was helped by a Zurich lawyer, Pietro Supino. This frontman would later become chairman of Tamedia, one of the biggest media groups in Switzerland. Rudolf Elmer also caused tax problems for Belgian businessman Philippe Stockley, whose documents show even to the eyes of Julius Baer that the trust was fictional. Ironically, Philippe Stockley had been lobbying Belgian authorities for years to obtain public subsidies to restore the famous Stockley Palace built in Brussels for his grandfather. These leaks spanned 14 months. They were the first ever important leaks of banking data via the internet. The lengthy investigation of British journalist Nick Davies, published in The Guardian, gave Rudolf Elmer international recognition.
Elmer's data is extremely interesting because it's very unusual for us to be able to see the detail of what goes on, A, inside a Swiss bank, which is a highly secretive organization, and B, inside a tax haven like the Caymans, which also is protected by specific secrecy law. And what Elmer gives us is hundreds and hundreds of pages of internal paperwork, which provides really close-up detail on the way that the bank operates and on the way that the tax haven operates.
As a grand finale, Elmer leaked the files of two big fish. The candidate for the presidency of Brazil in 2002, Rosana Sani, appeared as a beneficiary of the Coronado Trust based in Guernsey. She was forced to step down from the presidential race after police raided her company and found unexplained cash. Rudolf Elmer also leaked the bank files of a Mexican general who was convicted but then acquitted for colluding with drug traffickers. Arturo Acosta Chaparro was also accused of being responsible for more than 100 disappearances during Mexico's dirty war in the 1970s. His trust, managed by Julius Baer, held $3 million. Releasing such sensitive information into the public domain in a world where secrecy is the rule can change a person's life, especially when it's not done anonymously.
I don't want to patronize him, but I think I began to feel sorry for him. He has lost his career, and he's lost his peace of mind. I don't mean to say that he's mad, I just mean to say that he has a lot to worry about now. He has lost his income, and he's suffered from being isolated. And yet he does have something important to say.
To get his message out, Elmer wrote a book about his experience in tax havens. Meanwhile, he tried to earn a living by importing Indian beer onto the island. But he quickly ran out of money. Elmer's wife and daughter returned to Zurich.
Rudy's business hasn't started up so well, and he's still struggling with it. So this is why I'm here, to earn some money for the family. I live with my mother-in-law, and we share a flat, basically. My social life is very limited. I work long hours, and I go back home late. I'm keeping my costs low and trying not to spend extraordinary amounts of money. What I earn here, about half of it goes back to Mauritius to support Rudy there. At the moment, I'm trying to find a flat for us to bring him back here. I'm now trying to solve a problem, basically, and keeping the family together in any way I can. It's not that I chose to do this. I'm just kind of putting back together a broken glass.
Alone in Mauritius with no prospects, Rudolf Elmer was a little unsettled. The situation was beyond him. Persona non grata in the banking world, Elmer decided to go back to Switzerland to confront his demons. But he first stopped off in London to get advice and support.
There were drastic consequences on both sides, on the personal and then the professional life. A lot of friends stopped talking to us. We lost contact. I lost my job 3 times. The first time was in the Cayman Islands because I couldn't complete a lie detector test due to my physical problems. The second time it was with Noble Group when police in Zurich started the investigation. They put me to prison. They said they couldn't trust me anymore. So after that, we left for Mauritius, worked there for 2 years. And then the Standard Bank decided to stop my contract because of the blackmailing of Julius Baer. It's hard, and you are pushed to kind of to become an outlaw. In that sense, if you're a whistleblower, they treat you as a criminal, even so you come up with information which actually is going help to get the criminals, which is weird, but that's the reality.
Rudolf Elmer met with U.S. legal counsel for the first time. Jack A. Blum was already defending the interests of Heinrich Kieber, a whistleblower who'd caused a banking scandal in Liechtenstein.
Things I want to talk to you about, some of which I can talk to you about by the microphone on, and some will.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
The government of Liechtenstein says Kieber is a criminal. The government of Switzerland has tried to say Elmer is a criminal. The truth is, those governments are criminals. The people in their banks are criminals. They are aggressively promoting crime in other countries. Elmer has very serious difficulties. you know, we think of people who are refugees because of war or other problems. He's a refugee because of his attitude toward what he saw inside the banking system. And he should be at least entitled to the same kind of status as other refugees. There is an industry in the offshore world which is set up and makes its money by helping people in major countries cheat on their taxes. Now, the implications of that for the rest of us are extraordinary. We pay taxes. We are now confronting massive national deficits everywhere. We are being told that basic services will have to be cut because there's no money to pay for them. And here are the richest, most successful people in our societies who are saying, well, let them pay for it, not me. And that is an unacceptable proposition.
1 hour after this interview, the UK tax authorities were given a CD full of offshore banking data from the Standard Bank. Rudolf Elmer never knew if the data was used by tax authorities. Tax secrecy is just as untransparent as the sacrosanct banking secrecy.
There are very powerful organizations, by which I mean the majority of Swiss banks and British banks, that need to reassure their clients, that is tax evading clients and criminal clients from across the world, that their personal affairs are absolutely secure and hidden behind banking secrecy legislation, not just banking secrecy legislation, but secrecy arrangements of tax havens in the Caribbean, which use trusts and offshore companies. Their most profitable activities depend upon their clients feeling that their affairs are totally secret. And any indication that that secrecy is being blown by whistleblowers, or by leaks, or by steps to degrade banking secrecy at an international level will undermine their clients' confidence in their ability to secure secrecy. That's what's happening. In other words, an entire industry based upon secrecy is under threat, and these people are responding the only way they know how, which is to attack the people who are trying to degrade that secrecy. I've seen enough of the information he has, and I've spoken enough with Rudy over several years to feel this man does know what he's talking about. He's under great pressure personally, he's stressed, but he knows what he's talking about. The attacks on him are intended to undermine the integrity of what he's doing and to distract attention from the fact that he is challenging a system which is very deeply rooted and extremely aggressive at protecting itself. Most of the Swiss press that I saw reacted by, in English terms, going for the man, not the ball. In other words, if this was a football game, they fouled. They went for Rudy. They didn't look at the bank. And the bank put out press releases saying, look, here we have a rogue individual, heavily stressed, apparently psychologically deranged. So that distracted attention entirely from the issues that he was trying to raise. Now, we've seen this in many whistleblowing cases. This is how the public relations counter-attack happens. You don't draw attention to the issues or the data. You draw attention to the fact this individual has a chip on his shoulder. You know, he's psychologically deranged.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In recent months, robberies have been more visible in the United States, with several involving large groups rushing into stores and coming out with armloads of goods. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Michael Corkery, Sapna Maheshwari, and Jim Tankersley. The piece is titled, Thefts, Always an Issue for Retailers, Become More Brazen. Stay with us for more. Flash mobs swarm through a Nordstrom in Northern California and two Best Buy stores in Minnesota running out with armfuls of merchandise. Five thieves steal $20,000 in products from an Ulta Beauty store in Pennsylvania in just 40 seconds. A security guard is fatally shot in Oakland, California while working with a local television news crew reporting about a recent retail robbery by a group of thieves. Theft is an ever-present issue for retailers in the United States. As much as $68.9 billion of products were stolen from retailers in 2019, according to one industry group. But it has become more visible, more brazen and violent in recent months, forcing an industry already buffeted by pandemic lockdowns and fights over mask requirements to deal with a new problem. This level of violence has taken it to a whole new level, says Rachel Michelin, president of the California Retailers Association. No one has seen this before. Luxury retailers in Union Square in San Francisco, the site of several high-profile robberies this year, have boarded up windows to prevent more mayhem. Best Buy warned last week that theft was lowering profit margins, and said it was using QR codes for checkout in some areas so employees did not need to unlock items right away. Home Depot has hardened its stores, putting power tools and other valuables out of reach, and advising employees not to film robberies with their mobile phones because it could escalate the situation. It has become second nature to take out your phone and record something when it is happening, said Scott Glenn, vice president of asset protection at Home Depot, but these people are getting violent. Retail executives and security experts link the thefts to a confluence of factors, but primarily the ease with which thieves have been able to resell stolen goods on internet in places in websites like Amazon and Facebook. But even industry veterans who have been tracking generations of shoplifters have been stunned by the methods and mindset of the thieves, saying they reflect a sense of impunity. Some recent robberies in which large groups rush into a store, overwhelm employees and flee in cars before the police can respond recall the looting that occurred across the country amid protests after the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. At that time, people took advantage of police departments stretched by the protests and ransacked hundreds of stores, including the Macy's in Herald Square, and many smaller retailers, causing millions of dollars worth of damage. As tensions flared across the nation, major retailers like Nordstrom and Target would not discuss the extent of damage to their stores or how many they had to close during protests, instead focusing on their empathy for the demonstrators. The designer, Marc Jacobs, wrote on Instagram, "Never let them convince you that broken glass or property is violence. Property can be replaced, human lives cannot." With the unrest subsided, retailers are less reluctant to talk publicly about theft. Looting in general started during civil unrest, and it has now evolved, said Ben Duggan, president of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail, a trade group focused on crime at retailers. Criminal organizations saw during civil unrest that they were able to get their hands on millions of dollars of stolen products very quickly. The rise in thefts comes as punishments for retail theft have been broadly eased over the past decade. Since 2005, 30 states have increased the dollar threshold for theft offenses, which effectively means that fewer people are going to jail for smaller thefts, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. More than half of the states now have a felony theft threshold of $1,000 or more. The theft laws were changed to help reduce incarceration rates across the country, and some studies have found that the lower penalties have not led to more crime. And many of the most brazen crimes committed around Thanksgiving far exceeded the $1,000 threshold. Still, the thefts are being politicized, with some leaders saying they show the failure of decriminalization efforts. Others worry that the recent crimes could be used as a pretext to ratchet up penalties and incarceration rates again. Some industry experts say the problem is not necessarily the laws, but the lack of enforcement by the police and prosecutors, which emboldens enterprising thieves. A big priority, they say, should be breaking up the criminal organizations directing and profiting the most from the thefts. Ms. Michener, the head of the California Retail Trade Group, has been meeting with local prosecutors and the governor's office, which has established a task force on organized retail crime, trying to raise the urgency of prosecuting these cases. "The level of organized retail theft we are seeing today is simply unacceptable," California's Governor Gavin Newsom said in a statement. He added, "Businesses and customers should feel safe when doing their holiday shopping." Speaking to reporters on Friday, 3rd of December, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said federal law enforcement officials had been in contact with jurisdictions where we have seen this high level of retail theft. She added that the FBI was working with a task force led by the Los Angeles Police Department and that the Justice Department was providing money to hire 50 additional police officers in San Francisco, California. Both the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco have experienced high-profile retail robberies in recent weeks. Mr. Duggan, who has worked with a slew of major retailers and pharmacy chains like Walgreens, said that often the people snatching items are paid small fees like $500 for each robbery, which then feed larger enterprises that resell the goods online. Typically, these robberies don't involve large groups looting stores, but instead are smaller thefts that build up over time. In one recent case, a 70-year-old man in Atlanta, Georgia, paid recovering drug addicts to steal razors and health products from stores like Target, CVS, and Publix, and take them to his warehouse, according to court documents. The man, Robert Whitley, then sold the items online through businesses called Closeout Express and Essential Daily Discounts. He sold more than 140,000 items on Amazon's marketplace, totaling $3.5 million, according to federal prosecutors. Robert Whitley's lawyer said the thefts never involved violence. He said Mr. Whitley, who had struggled with drug addiction himself, ran support groups and provided shelter for others struggling with substance abuse. Robert Whitley, who pleaded guilty to one count of interstate transportation of stolen property, was sentenced in October to nearly 6 years in federal prison. His daughter, Nonnie Whitley, who was accused of being part of the illegal operation, was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. Similar cases have occurred from Katy, Texas to Charlotte, North Carolina, and help explain why in many big box chains and drugstores around the country, items like teeth whitening strips and razor blades are increasingly being put behind lock and key. Stolen goods used to show up at flea markets and pawn shops, but that has changed in recent years. One of the biggest issues that brick-and-mortar retailers have been grappling with is the rapid growth of online marketplaces, where anyone can easily sell goods, often anonymously. Amazon, eBay, Facebook Marketplace, OfferUp, Etsy, all of those are utilized by illicit online sellers, and they're allowed to get away with it because the illicit sellers are allowed to operate with anonymity on the internet, Mr. Duggan said. They don't have to list their real name or real addresses or location or their real banking information, so no one is concerned about being caught if they're not even using their real name. Consumers are often unaware of the provenance of items they're buying, but issues can emerge with products like baby formula, which can be expired or otherwise compromised when stolen. The anonymity reflects yet another instance in which criminals stymied by rules in the physical world can operate freely on the internet, an issue that has surfaced in problems involving misinformation, questionable advertisements, and merchandise glorifying crimes. Pawn shops, for example, are regulated in almost every state, said Richard Rossman, a sergeant with the Broward County Sheriff's Office in Florida, who is also part of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail. The Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail has gotten support from industry groups and retailers, including pharmacy chains Home Depot and Ulta Beauty, on partisan legislation known as the Informed Consumers Act. The bill would require online marketplaces to authenticate the identity of high-volume third-party sellers, including their bank account information and tax identification, and allow consumers to see basic identification and contact information for those sellers. Etsy, OfferUp, and eBay said they support the legislation after opposing a draft of the legislation that raised privacy and safety concerns for sellers. Meta said that Facebook Marketplace users could report items they thought were stolen, and that law enforcement could contact the company regarding suspicious items. Amazon said in a statement that we regularly request invoices, purchase orders, and other proofs of sourcing when we have concerns about how a seller may have obtained particular products that they want to sell. Amazon added that it employed 10,000 people working to prevent fraud and abuse on its site and supported the Informed Consumers Act.
Aperture. At the height of the Cold War, the CIA launches a highly classified, top secret research program into the covert use of biological and chemical agents. In simulated attacks on enemy populations, entire cities throughout America are contaminated with bacteria, exposing millions of Americans to germ warfare. But the real focus of the research is on mastering the art of mind control. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. LSD had become one of the CIA's key interests for its brain warfare program. As the agency theorized, it could be useful in interrogations. Mind control experiments generally centered around behavior modification via electroshock therapy, hypnosis, polygraphs, radiation, and a variety of drugs, toxins, and chemicals. And these experiments relied on a range of test subjects, some who freely volunteered, some who volunteered under coercion, and some who had absolutely no idea that they're involved in a sweeping defense research program. And what was the extent of these brainwashing experiments? How did the CIA use unconsenting people as guinea pigs in thousands of different experiments? Join us on Aperture for your answers on CIA covert experiments.
August 16th, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. In Pont Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. The first dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades, the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed, not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Albarelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Albarelli then made the link with the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont-Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont-Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps. Notably, horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946, in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, To test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved. And afterwards, the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? You think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came in this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus, long held responsible for the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the Army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made. And if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't. And so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MK-Ultra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons